Now a descending view of bustling Baker Street. Horse-drawn carriages trot along past merchants, workers, and crowded storefronts. Opening titles appear. Granada Television presents Jeremy Brett and Edward Hardwick in The Casebook of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Hawkers sell newspapers to passers-by dressed in top hats and long coats. A bobby waves away street urchins from the front of a shop. From his second-story window, the dashing, sharp-nosed Sherlock Holmes turns toward us with a bemused smile, his sleek profile framed by a view of the wagon-filled street. The scene freezes and dissolves to a tintype photograph. Now, from a steep, grassy slope, our view scans down a mountain ravine. A dead, fallen tree lies just beneath. Jagged rocks outline a trickling stream's path. A man in a gray suit, knickers, and black hat races down a hill. We see a body wearing brown leather boots. A soiled white slip peeks out from beneath a brown wool skirt. A gloved hand extends toward a thrown-open map. Our view then glides across a blue wool coat with brown lapels. The gray-suited man scrambles up a rock to where a young woman with dark brown hair lies in a heap on her back. Her large blue eyes are wide open, her face pale as blood trickles down from the corner of her mouth.
Oh. Oh, my dear. My dearest. I warned you, I said, do not go too near the edge.
Why did you push me, Baron?
Dear wife, you're dreaming. Oh,
dying.
Her eyes close. Her head collapses in his hand.
Oh, my darling.
He kisses her on the forehead. He looks up the hill. A shepherd boy and his dog gaze down at him. The scene changes to a steaming Turkish bathhouse. A masseur in white balloon pants rubs down a patron. Titles appear. Anthony Valentine, David Langton, Abigail Cruttenden, and Kim Thompson in The Illustrious Client, dramatized by Robin Chapman. A man dives into a pool. A Mediterranean man in a billowy white shirt, red vest, and pants folds a towel. He enters a room where other men dressed like him prepare linens. Now Holmes and Watson sit in a private section of the bath, wrapped in heavy white towels. Holmes is in a meditative cross-legged position. Watson reclines, smoking his pipe.
Anything stirring, Holmes?
I know no more than this.
Holmes pulls a letter from beneath a towel and hands it to Watson.
It may be some fussy, self-important fool. It may be a matter of life or death.
You grant this interview?
I've already confirmed it. Do you know anything of the man?
Only that the name Colonel Sir James Damery is a household word in society.
I can tell you a little bit more than that. He has rather a reputation for arranging delicate matters which are to be kept out of the papers. He's a man of the world with a natural turn for diplomacy. I'm bound, therefore, to hope that it is not a false scent, that he has some real need of our assistance.
Our?
If you will be so good, Watson.
I should be honored.
Holmes smiles.
Then until 4:30 o'clock, we can put the matter out of our heads.
Eyes closed, he draws from a glass, bell-shaped hookah. Later in Holmes's flat.
Mr. Holmes, we are dealing on this occasion with the most dangerous man in Europe.
I have had several opponents to whom that flattering term has been applied.
A man to whom violence is familiar and who will literally stick at nothing.
Did you smoke? Excuse my pipe. But if your man is more dangerous than the late Professor Moriarty, he's indeed worth meeting. May I ask his name?
Have you ever heard of Baron Gruner?
Holmes turns to Sir James.
The Austrian murderer.
So you've already sized him up as a murderer?
It is our business to follow the details of continental crime.
I'm as sure that he killed his wife when that so-called accident happened at the Splugen Pass as if I'd seen him do it. Just as I am certain that he disposed of the only witness, That innocent shepherd boy.
Baron Gruner is now in England.
Residing near Kingston, I'm informed.
That is so. Might I also suppose you will have heard of General Merville?
Khyber Pass fame.
Indeed. General Merville has a daughter, Violet. Young, rich, accomplished. A wonder woman in every way. It is she, an innocent, we are endeavoring to save from the clutches of this fiend.
He has some hold over her.
The strongest of all where women are concerned, Mr. Holmes.
Ah, love.
Exactly.
Now a couple walks down a stately garden path.
In marrying you, my darling, all my past sins shall be absolved.
These aren't sins you told me of. These are slanders.
My angel.
You were traduced, as are all great men.
Yet I am determined you shall know my history, every part of it. Thus shall I come to the altar, purified in soul and spirit, and worthy at last of your love.
Just 6 weeks. Oh, Adelbert.
Baron Gruner kisses Violet's hand. She gazes into his eyes.
I cannot pretend my past is without stain. No man born in poverty who has created his own fortune can say that and speak the truth or not. I have been forced to many a ruthless act, my dear. Where should I begin? With young Heinrich of Saxe Baden.
To observe, Mr. Holmes, an atrocious event preparing itself before your very eyes and yet be powerless to avert it. Could anyone, any human being, be placed in a more trying position?
Perhaps not.
Well, then you will sympathize with the client in whose interest I am acting.
Holmes stares wide-eyed at Sir James.
I did not understand that you were merely an intermediary. Who is the principal?
I beg of you not to press that question. His name cannot be dragged into this matter. His motives are to the last degree honorable, but he prefers to remain unknown. I need not say that your fees will be assured, Mr. Holmes.
Holmes darts out of his seat to the door.
And you will be allowed a free hand.
Sir James turns to Watson.
Surely the actual name of your client is immaterial.
I must decline to act, Sir James. I'm sorry. I'm accustomed to having mystery at one end of my cases, but having it at both ends is too confusing. No.
You place me in the most serious dilemma. Dare I say, Mr. Holmes, you hardly realize the effect of your own action. I have given my word not to reveal the identity of my client. May I at the least lay all I can before you?
Holmes re-enters the room, jaws tight. He crosses to the mantel. An ornate mirror reflects his wrinkled brow. He faces Sir James.
It is understood. I commit myself to nothing.
Well, of course. Yes.
Now in a study.
A perfect likeness.
Gruner smiles.
Who painted it?
Hans of Innsbruck. A descendant of Klaus, the sculptor famous for his bronzes, such as this. I shall commission Hans to attempt your likeness, my precious.
I love this room. It breathes of you.
Violet takes Gruner's hands. They embrace. He kisses her cheek.
What's this?
A leather-bound book.
Your diary?
No. It is my commonplace book. In it, I record things I've seen, read, admired. Occasionally, perhaps, a thought or two of my own.
But it's locked.
It is a little part of me, besides. A servant might pry. One day, perhaps, we shall look at it together.
No. I respect your privacy, my darling. We must all keep something of our own, however much else we share.
You are perfect.
Later, in a hall displaying china.
You must teach me about porcelain, Adelbert.
I shall. Collecting is such a pleasure, such a delight. It is a passion with me, just as you are, my precious.
Back in Holmes's flat.
The villain has attached himself to a lady with such effect that he has completely and absolutely won her heart. She will not hear one word against him. To sum up, she proposes to marry him next month. As she is of age and has a will of iron, it's hard to know how to prevent her.
Holmes writes a note, then rings for the maid.
Does the infatuated young woman know of the Swiss episode?
The cunning devil has told her every unsavory scandal of his past life, but always in such a way as to make himself out to be the innocent martyr. She accepts his version and will listen to no other, not even her father's.
Dear me, Sir James, have you not inadvertently let out the name of your client?
The general? Oh, no, Dr. Watson. That strong soldier's been utterly demoralized by this incident.
Holmes, note in hand, stands by the door, listening attentively with a mischievous smile.
Mrs. Hudson!
You rang, sir?
Will you deliver this to the butcher's boy round the corner?
That young rascal with the funny eye?
The other is invaluable, so is his bicycle.
Holmes walks toward his seat, flips up his coattails, then sits.
How may I keep in touch with you, Sir James?
You accept my commission?
Let us just say that your problem interests me.
The Carlton Club will find me.
And the Baron's exact address in Kingston?
Vernon Lodge. A large house. He's a rich man.
Well, speculators, when successful, frequently are, Sir James. What further information can you give us about the man?
He has expensive tastes. Collects books, pictures, oh, and Chinese pottery. He's a recognized authority. Written a book upon the subject.
Well, Sir James, you may tell your client that I'm turning my attention towards Baron Gruner.
I have no doubt, Mr. Holmes, you could easily trace my client. But I must ask you as a point of honor to refrain from doing so. Do not, I beg you, break in upon his incognito.
I think I can safely promise that.
Thank you. Dr. Watson.
Holmes escorts the gray-haired, distinguished Sir James as he exits. Watson, eyebrows arched, turns to a glass-enclosed bookcase and removes a volume, Who's Who in 1902. He quickly leafs through the pages.
You're wasting your time, Watson.
Now, the career of General Merville might well give us a pointer as to our client. He's clearly illustrious.
But did you not hear, Sir James?
His request was to you, Holmes.
But that is shameful, Watson. Shameful. Besides, our minds should be more gainfully employed. Desist.
Watson shoots Holmes a cold stare.
Any views?
Have you none?
Not yet. Beyond the one I've already acted upon.
The butcher's boy.
More discreet than any telegraph.
Well, I should think you'd better see the young lady herself. Start with her.
If a poor broken-down father cannot move, how can I, a complete stranger, prevail?
Well, if all else fails,
perhaps. But first, the underworld. For it is among the dark roots of crime that we must hunt for Gruner's secrets.
Holmes stares thoughtfully. Watson smirks.
You've sent for Shinwell Johnson.
I have but one insight. That Miss Merville might well condone murder. Yet some smaller offense might rankle. We shall see.
Now in his study, Gruner taps Holmes's calling card on his desk.
They have engaged the very best. Show him in.
Gruner's butler leads Holmes down a hall. Holmes glances at the china as he passes.
Mr. Sherlock Holmes, sir.
Holmes wears a crisp black suit and coat. Gruner stares out a large picture window, his back to Holmes.
I rather thought I should see you sooner or later, Mr. Holmes.
Hands behind his back, Gruner turns to face him.
You've been retained, no doubt, by General Merville to prevent my marriage with his daughter Violet. That is so, is it not?
Holmes stares at him.
Let me advise you very strongly, Mr. Holmes, to draw off at once, sir.
Draw off?
My dear man, you'll only ruin your well-deserved reputation. This is not a case in which you can possibly hope to succeed. Draw off, sir.
It is curious, but that is the very advice that I've come to give you. Let me put it to you, man to man. If you persist in this marriage, you will raise such a swarm of powerful enemies. England will be too hot to hold you.
He glares at Gruner.
Surely you would be wiser to draw off.
Excuse my amusement, Mr. Holmes, but it really is very funny seeing you trying to play a hand with no cards in it. Not a color card there, sir. Nothing but the smallest of the small.
So you think?
So I know, sir. So I know. Let me make the thing clear to you.
You consider your hand so strong that you could afford to show it?
Certainly, since it becomes plain that in this instance you are clearly out of your depth, Mr. Holmes. Could it be that your capabilities have been subject to hyperbole?
Your hand, Gruner, show it.
Gruner extends his palm.
Won't you sit down?
I think I shan't.
Please yourself.
Gruner rounds his desk and sits in a leather armchair.
Well, sir. It happens I have been fortunate enough to win the entire affection of Miss Mervyn. This in spite of the fact that I have informed her clearly of all the unhappy incidents in my past. I have warned her that certain designing persons would come to her. I hope you recognize yourself from this. And would tell her of these things. I have instructed her how to treat them. She is well prepared for you.
Holmes frowns down at him.
She will no doubt give you an appointment. And she will listen. It will be to no avail, however. If you wish to speak, now is your moment.
Holmes, with an icy gray gaze.
No. This is not the moment.
He strides toward the door.
Oh, by the way, Mr. Holmes, did you know the French agent Lebrun?
Of course.
So you know what befell him?
He was beaten in the Montmartre district of Paris and crippled for life.
Quite so. By an odd coincidence, he had been inquiring into my affairs. Don't do it, Mr. Holmes. It's not a lucky thing. My last word to you is, you go your way. Let me go mine.
Gruner lights a cigar.
And mine to you, Gruner, is if you aspire to be accepted into English society, you'd do well to remove the ban from your Havana before lighting it. Otherwise, you'll be put down for a bounder.
Gruner stiffens as he watches Holmes leave. Blowing out his match, he smirks. Later, in Holmes's parlor, a rugged, stocky man in work clothes and a woman with red, sideswept hair sit patiently.
Now, Mrs. Hudson, has Holmes returned?
Not yet, sir, but there are two visitors waiting.
Thank you, Mrs. Hudson.
Watson hangs his coat and hat on a stand and enters the room.
Why, Johnson?
Evening, Doctor. Mr. Holmes sent word to me.
I know, Johnson, I know.
And I've brought Kid here because...
After I was delayed at the museum, and then the press of traffic, an omnibus overturned in Great Russell Street. Too dead a horse had to be put down. Gentlemen, forgive me. I was absorbed by the mysteries of Ming. I quite forgot the hour, madam.
This is Miss Winter, Mr. Holmes. Kitty, we call her. And what you don't know about Gruner.
Of course, please.
Well, Kitty can speak for herself. Anyway, I'll put my hand right on her within an hour of your message, sir.
I'm easy to find. Hell, London gets me every time. Same address goes for Porky.
Porky? Is that your nom de guerre, Johnson? You've never revealed that. Porky? Oh, well.
We're old mates, Porky and me. But there's someone who ought to be down in a lower hell than us. And that's the man you're after, Mr. Holmes.
I gather we have your good wishes, Miss Winter.
If I can help put him where he belongs, I'm yours to the rattle, sir.
Do you know what he intends? How the matter stands?
Porky tells me he's after some other poor fool. Only this time he wants to marry her. And you want to stop it.
Yes.
Surely you know enough about this devil to prevent any decent girl in her senses wanting to have anything to do with him.
But she's not in her senses, Miss Winter. She's madly in love. And she has been told all about him.
She cares for nothing.
Told about the murder of his wife?
Yes.
My lord. She must have a nerve.
She has.
Can't you lay proofs before her?
Can you help us do so?
I am proof. Living proof.
She purses her lips.
If I was to stand before her and tell her how he used me...
Would you do this?
Would I? Would I not?
It might be worth the trying.
Our lady didn't tell her all, sir.
All?
Kitty stares ahead blankly.
He collected me. He collects women. I was an artist model. A respectable artist model.
Of course, you sat with that painting in his study.
You've been to Kingston. Then you'll have seen all his crocs. Women and China. They're his twin passions. Gruner commissioned that painting. And afterwards... And after... Well, let's just say I can never work again.
I am exceedingly obliged to you, Miss Winter. We shall indeed interview Miss Merville together. My client will compensate you most liberally.
Oh, none of that, Mr. Holmes. I'm not out for money. Just let me see this man in the mud. In the mud with my foot in his face. That's my price.
Outside, a bicycle courier in a blue uniform and cap pulls up to Holmes's door. Kitty and Johnson leave. The courier hands Mrs. Hudson a telegram.
Thank you.
Two figures lurk in the shadows across the street. They follow Kitty and Johnson. Inside, Holmes reads the telegram.
From Kingston. Thank you, Mrs. Hudson. No reply. Shall we dine?
He hands the telegram to his colleague. Watson's eyes widen.
But this is a death threat, Holmes.
Do you expect anything less than the Baron Gruner?
Holmes, have a care.
Oh, Watson, come along. We must eat.
Holmes swirls on his coat and strides out. The scene changes to Kitty and Johnson making their way down Baker Street. Johnson, his thumb anchored in his belt, looks over his shoulder and sees two men following. The men, dressed in work clothes and derby hats, walk 5 paces behind them. Johnson watches them over his shoulder. As they turn the corner, Johnson grabs Kitty's hand.
Come on, go!
They dash across the street. Kitty hikes up her skirt, revealing a white ruffled petticoat. In flight, Johnson kicks over a drunk holding a bottle. The two thugs shove the drunk aside. Kitty and Johnson run through a gate and down an alley. Following closely, the two thugs plow through the gate after them. Johnson and Kitty hesitate at a cross alley. Then Johnson opens a large black door. Billowing steam shoots at them as they duck into the back of a Chinese laundry. Men in black mandarin shirts and ponytails stare at them as they run through. Outside, the thugs run by. Later, under a bridged canal.
They ain't following no more.
Don't you believe it?
Johnson drags a breathless Kitty along. The thugs appear from the shadows in front of them.
Yeah, what did I say? Now, you stand over there, Kitty. There's a good girl. Right. Who's first? You or you?
Johnson lunges toward one thug, swinging. The other thug grabs Kitty. Johnson gives his opponent a headbutt, knocking him unconscious. The thug holding Kitty swings a club at Johnson and misses. Johnson counters with several blows to the midsection. The thug doubles over. Johnson pounds him across the back with a forearm. Then, straightening him up, he grabs him by the collar. Grimacing, Johnson balls his fist. He draws his arm back, staring at the man's stunned, bloodied face. With a simple push, Johnson sends the thug's stiffened body into the canal.
Amateurs. Ain't done no time. Don't know nothing. Come on, girl.
Johnson takes Kitty's arm and leads her down the walkway. Now, sitting at the desk in his study, a relaxed Gruner, dressed in a blue smoking jacket, fingers the pages of his leather-bound book. In it are tintype photographs of women, a number of them topless, some elegantly dressed in high lace collars and hats. Under each picture is a handwritten caption. The handwriting is neat and the wording sparse on each page. Grenner takes out a photograph of Violet. Raising a pair of sharp steel scissors, he carefully clips the corners of the photograph. He turns to a clean page, smoothing it with a well-manicured hand. He blows the page. He deposits the scissors on the desk, then carefully uncorks a jar of white adhesive. His lips press together. His high brow wrinkles. He brushes on the adhesive in several short strokes. He picks up the photograph of Violet. She is staring out blankly in a high-collared blouse. He places it down firmly. He places a white linen handkerchief over it, rubs the page, and removes the handkerchief. Grenner looks up. His butler stands in the doorway.
There's two persons wish to see you, sir.
Persons?
I couldn't in honesty term them gentlemen, sir.
I come.
He locks the clasp on his book, rises, and crosses to a mahogany bureau. He unlocks a small door with gold-capped columns. He places the book inside, locks it, and takes the key. Now in the hallway with the two thugs, one holds a handkerchief to his nose.
Was he armed?
No, sir.
Go through to the kitchens. Clean yourselves up and clear out.
The two thugs hesitate, their eyes downcast, then shrink down the hallway. Grinner's jaw tightens as he stares forward. Daytime. Holmes and Kitty Winter sit in an open carriage rounding a corner. Later, Holmes walks up to a black door and presses the tip of his slender black cane against a bright brass door buzzer. Inside with Violet.
I have agreed to this visit out of respect for my father, Mr. Holmes, rather than for you. My fiancé assures me you are no longer what you were. A spent force.
His eyebrows rise.
And you, Miss Winter? Surely you must also be superfluous.
Our intentions are the best.
They sit down.
We are here to aid you.
Really? When you call to malign my fiancé?
I am not renowned, Miss Melville, for the warmth of my affections. But I can appreciate them in others. Had I a daughter, I should, I hope, feel for you as the General does. Nor is his concern without foundation.
There. The slander begins.
I do not readily call upon anyone to beg or to plead. But in Baron Grunner, please, I never speak idly. You have chosen not merely unwisely, but dangerously. Marry him, Miss Merville, and I assure you, with all the knowledge I have of the criminal mentality, you will be in mortal danger. Just as the former Baroness was, she too is infatuated and paid the fatal price. Her life for a fortune.
That's a lie.
Holmes shoots her a doubtful look.
You are, of course, aware that the Splugen Pass, where your predecessor died, runs between Italy and Switzerland.
What does the geography matter?
A great deal. When you plan to hurl a helpless woman off a cliff in one country to break her neck in another.
But it was an accident.
Then why did the shepherd boy, who saw the Baroness fall, die of arsenical poison? His murderess, whom Grunner had seduced, confessed at a trial that he had obliged her to administer the fatal substance or risk disfigurement for life. by oil of vitriol.
Kitty's eyes drop.
Those are the facts, Miss Merville. I beg you. Picture the awful situation you will find yourself in if you only wake to your fiancé's true character after you have married him.
Violet frowns warily at Holmes, then stands and turns her back to him. She presses her mouth closed and gazes down pensively.
I have listened to you with patience, Mr. Holmes. I am aware my fiancé has had a stormy life, in which he has incurred most unjust aspersions. Possibly you mean well, though I learn you are a paid agent. But in any case, I love Baron Gruner, and he loves me.
Holmes shoots up from his chair and crosses the room away from her.
You have told me this young lady's name and that there is a reason for her presence.
I'll say there is.
And what exactly are you, Miss Winter?
Me? I'll tell you. I'll tell you what I am. I was his mistress, Zetsu. One of 100. More. He's tempted, used, ruined, and thrown aside as he will you too.
Please.
You marry this man, he'll be the death of you. Maybe a broken heart or a broken neck, but he'll have you.
Oh, really?
You may think yourself different.
Thank you, Kitty. You made yourself admirably clear.
I am aware of 3 occasions in my fiancé's life when he has become entangled with designing women. And I am assured by him of his hearty repentance.
Him? Repent? And only 3? Oh, you fool. You stupid fool.
Mr. Holmes, I have obeyed my father's wish in seeing you. But I'm not compelled to listen to the slanderous ravings.
Ravings? Ravings? My God. I'll show you.
Kitty stands, glaring at Violet, who takes a step back. Kitty draws her hair back and pulls down her collar, exposing her ear and neck.
Look.
A long scar, swollen and pocked.
Look.
Both Violet and Holmes stare, aghast. She unbuttons her blouse.
And here.
Her chest mottled with scars.
Oil of vitriol. He did it. Oh, yes. He did it. Your fiancé.
That's a lie. It's a lie.
Thank you.
Holmes places a gentle hand on Kitty's shoulder. She dashes out. Violet stares woefully at Holmes, who glares back, then hastens to the door.
You can tell the Baron that I shall not rest until I bring him to justice.
He leaves Violet standing alone in the parlor. Kitty races out of the gate into the street.
Miss Winter!
Holmes puts on his top hat and jogs into the street. A carriage passes just in front of him. He hurries to his carriage, where Kitty sits bent over, clutching her collar. He sits beside her, and the carriage takes off.
Why, Kitty? Why?
No, please.
Why did Gruner treat you so?
Because... No, I can't tell you, Mr. Holmes.
You must this instant. You said that he collects women. What did you mean by that?
It's a book he has.
A book?
Brown leather. With a lock. And his coat of arms in gold on it. No, I can't speak of it.
He keeps a record of his women?
We're all in there. Photographs, names, details, everything about us. He tried to make me read it while he... Oh, no, I can't.
And when you refused?
He went berserk. He ran out of the room. I was trying to dress. He'd come back in with this bottle. I was half naked. He threw it straight at me.
Where is this book?
I don't know.
Think?
No, no.
In the study, in the bedroom?
It's more than a year since I was there.
Then you can remember, Kitty. Think.
In the study. Back of the bureau.
Thank you, Kitty.
Now Holmes and Watson in a restaurant.
Miss Winter's scars could not move, Miss Merville?
She was shocked, but recovered instantly.
Good heavens. Seems inhuman.
I confess that part of me could wish her joy with Gruner.
Abandon her to her fate.
after all this? When I compare Miss Merville with Kitty, whose spirit is as fine as her body is blemished, yes.
He wouldn't withdraw from the case.
Have no fear, Watson. My disgust with Miss Merville counts as nothing against my determination to foil Gruner. But one thing irks me. That I did not pay more regard to Kitty's deportment when we first met. The manner in which you dressed her hair. Oh. It's late.
He signs the check swiftly.
We must be gone.
In the hallway, Holmes and Watson climb a staircase.
I've got a mountain of work to do at the surgery, Holmes, so I'll see you in the morning.
Until tomorrow, then.
They enter a foggy, gaslit street. Holmes, black cane in hand, turns a corner. The angular shadow of his profile, peaked with his top hat, darkens a brick wall as he walks down an alleyway.
All right, Sherlock Holmes, let's be having you.
Ah, and I can guess to whom I owe this pleasure.
He throws his top hat off. Two derby-hatted thugs wield clubs at Holmes. He fends off their first swings with his cane, pelting one of them across the jaw, the other in the stomach. As he blocks another swing, one of the thugs comes up behind him and slugs him across the back. He grabs Holmes around the chest, while the other thug beats Holmes across the stomach. Holmes falls to the ground as we see the enormous shadows of the two thugs flailing Holmes' body. They stop. One of them shoves Holmes' body over with his foot. They walk away, leaving Holmes unconscious, blood dripping from the corner of his mouth. A man with a wooden peg leg stands on a bustling street corner. Well-dressed men pause at his stand, take a paper, and drop a coin into a metal cup. Dr. Watson rounds the corner and dashes to the newsstand. He grabs a paper, searching the headlines. Dropping a coin into the cup, he hurries away. Later, Watson enters a doorway. He runs up the steps, opens a dark wooden door, and steps in. Holmes lies on his bed in the shadows of a heavy curtain, a bandage around his head, his arms folded across his chest.
It's all right, Watson. Don't look so scared.
You mustn't talk.
Nonsense. Need to.
What can I do, Holmes? Because it was that damned Austrian. Give me the word, and I'll go and thrash the hide off him.
Good old Watson. No.
Was it the same pair that attacked Johnson and Miss Winter?
One may have been. The other, I doubt it. But your thought alerts me. You must send a note to Johnson. Tell him to find some quiet suburb for Kitty. She should stay there until the danger has passed. And then... then we must exaggerate my injuries.
There's no need for that.
Even so, we must lay it on thick for the press. May not live the week out. Concussion, delirium, coma, what you like. We must issue the gravest bulletins.
Anything more?
Yes. Put my pipe on the table from the tobacco slipper.
You must rest, not smoke.
Oh, very well. Doctor.
The scene changes to a sunny garden porch. Baron Gruner, sipping from an ornate cup, reads a newspaper account of Holmes's injuries. Violet walks up the steps of the porch carrying a basket of flowers.
Ah, oh, my dearest, every day you become more precious to me.
She sits down, ignoring his outstretched arms, staring down in a pout.
What is it?
Must you really go to America?
Oh, my darling. It's only a short trip. I have important financial business, certain interests to regulate in Chicago. But I shall be back so soon, in the twinkle of an eye.
The late additions, sir.
Thank you. Have you seen the papers? That poor man Holmes, he sinks daily.
I'm afraid you cannot expect me to have very much sympathy with Mr. Holmes and his misfortune.
Erysipelas has set in.
Later, in Holmes's bedroom.
Have you seen the news?
No.
Luna sails for America on the Royal Retainer on Friday.
News that hits hard. Friday? That means he sails from Liverpool, not from Southampton. I believe the rascal means to get away from us. But he won't. By the Lord Harry, he won't. Watson, I need you to do something for me.
I'm here to be used.
Then spend the next 24 hours in an intensive study of Chinese pottery.
Watson looks up, squinting thoughtfully. Later, our view scans closely across the bindings of books lying in stacks. In between the stacks, a hand turns the page of an opened book. We see Watson reading intently, drawing on a small straight pipe couched in the corner of his mouth. He squints and props his hand underneath his chin. In bed, Holmes covers his perspiring face with a bandaged hand and tosses fretfully. Now Watson peers at a book through a magnifying glass.
Home Woe, 1368-39. Home Woe, 1368-39.
Watson shakes his head. Later, Holmes, a thermometer in his mouth, looks up, propping his hands behind his head. Watson reaches over, still reading his book, and takes the thermometer out of Holmes's mouth. He turns the page and traces down a paragraph with the thermometer. Glancing at his hand, he reads the thermometer briefly and shakes the mercury down, getting up from the bedside. Holmes watches, a slight smile on his lips, his left eye ringed with welts trailing down his cheek. Now, Watson reclines on a sofa, holding a book above his head. Stencils of Chinese vases adorn the pages. Later, Mrs. Hudson draws the covers up to Holmes's chin and pats him gently on the shoulder. She extinguishes the glass-domed lamp on the wall at his bedside. Holmes's silhouette is lit in a soft, pale light as Mrs. Hudson closes the door. She crosses into the study, where Watson dozes in a wicker chair. He starts as she approaches.
He's sleeping now, sir.
That'll be the morphine.
You won't let the lamp smoke, will you?
No. You're locked up below.
Oh, I did that a while back. There's murderous folk about.
True.
Don't drive yourself too hard, sir. You'll be good for nothing in the morning.
No, I shan't be long.
Morning. Holmes takes a business card from an envelope and hands it to Watson.
Dr. Hill Barton, 369 Half Moon Street, Mayfair West. Who's this?
You.
Me?
That is your name this evening, Dr. Hill Barton.
It is?
Yes, when you call upon Baron Gruner at 8:30. He'll be disengaged. They've sent a note telling him that you'll call.
A velvet box at Holmes's side.
Also that you're bringing this.
A delicate porcelain bowl.
It is the real eggshell of the Ming Dynasty. The complete set would be worth a king's ransom. You are a collector. The set has come your way. We've heard of the Baron's interest. Not averse to selling at a price.
What price?
You do not exaggerate if you say it could hardly be matched in the world. Sir James got it for me. It comes from the collection of his client.
Well, I could say that it should be valued by an expert.
Oh, Watson, you scintillate today. I suggest Sotheby's, Christie.
You're certain he'll see me?
Oh, yes. It's the collection mania in its most acute form.
One last question, Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
Why have you made me a broker in antiques?
To gain time. The opportunity to acquire a set such as this may persuade the Baron to postpone his visit to the United States.
Now I understand.
Elementary psychology, Watson.
Nighttime. Watson shuts the door of 221B and walks into the street carrying a black cane and leather bag. He hails a coach with a silver-tipped cane. In a darkened doorway nearby, Kitty watches. Watson crosses the street to the tall, square hackney, lamps on each side.
Kingston, please, driver.
Watson opens the door, steps into the cab, and sits down. As the carriage pulls away, Kitty dashes across the street and jumps onto the back. Inside, Watson grimaces anxiously.
Song Quan.
The hackney rolls through a gateway up a dark, misty lane lit by a street lamp.
1426.
Now the back of the hackney briefly lit up as it passes the street lamp, the blue cab etched with white above a black frame. It rolls up to Vernon Lodge, now in Gruner's study.
Very fine.
Gruner and Watson study the delicate bowl.
Very fine, indeed.
His jaw quivers with a smile. His trembling hand reaches for the bowl, then pulls back.
And you say you have a set to correspond?
Watson nods calmly.
I know of only one in England to match it. Would it be indiscreet of me if I were to ask how you obtained this?
Does it really matter?
Of course it matters with precious objects such as these provenances or...
Well, you can see the piece is genuine. As to the value, I'm perfectly content to take an expert's assessment.
I had supposed you were an expert, Dr. Hill-Barton.
I meant an independent assessment.
Of course. I have some recently acquired pieces of celadon you might care to view.
By all means.
Please.
Gruner stands, Watson following. Now Watson inspects a glossy white tea bowl, holding it lightly in his hands.
It's flawless. Typical 12th century Song, I'd say. Wouldn't you?
Gruner takes the bowl.
You're right.
He carefully places it in a glass-shelved cabinet on a small, intricately carved black tripod.
And this?
He walks Watson around the display cabinet, vases, bowls, and cups positioned inside. He stops and motions to a collection of small vases.
That's an excellent example. Jin Dynasty, I should say, circa 265 AD.
Precisely.
He rounds the cabinet, its wooden frame inlaid with golden designs, to a slate-blue vase and pale green bowls.
And these? Typical of celadon, would you say?
Give me time.
I am giving you time, sir.
Quite so.
I should also be interested in your views on the marks of the Hung Wu.
The marks of the Hung Wu? That's a vexed question.
Vexed question indeed, sir. There are no marks on the genuine Hung Wu.
This is intolerable, sir. I came here to do you a favor, not to be examined as if I were a schoolboy.
You came here to spy.
Not so.
You may have found it easy to inveigle your way in here upon false pretenses, but by God, sir, you shall find it harder to get out. Raise your hands above your head, Dr. Watson.
He aims a pistol. Watson raises his hands.
What's that?
He rushes into his study.
Holmes! You! Don't move!
Holmes, a bandage on his head, stands by an open French door.
I shall shoot you through the head, rather than the heart. And then inform the police. I mistook you for a common burglar.
That is a role that I played before. With some success.
Without any doubt, sir, this will be your last time.
Baron! Kitty!
Kitty rushes in and throws a vial of liquid at Gruner.
There. Be done by as you did.
She dashes out. Watson runs in, grabs a flask of water, and kneels beside Gruner as the butler enters.
Get more! I'll telephone the Baron's
physician.
Watson pours water onto Gruner's face. Across the room, Holmes unlocks the small door on Gruner's bureau and removes the leather-bound book. Holmes stares at the well-crafted design, then up at Gruner's portrait on a wall. Splashed with a vile liquid, the painting smokes and blisters. Later, Holmes reclines on his sofa as Watson shows in Sir James.
Ah, Sir James, forgive me for summoning you at this late hour. But there's no time to be lost. You must have this before Scotland Yard bumbles in.
Scotland Yard?
Baron Grun is bound to have laid a complaint against us. Watson as an imposter, myself as a burglar. We were both.
I diverted Gruner's attention while Holmes procured that. You must show it to Miss Merville. She will find herself one among 100.
The account of what sport Baron Grunner enjoyed with his female victims may perhaps at last open Miss Merville's eyes.
You've done wonders, Holmes. Wonders.
Except for Kitty Winter. Watson, explain. I must rest.
Miss Winter is a former mistress of Gruner's. She followed me to Kingston and concealed about her was a flask of vitriol.
Which she unleashed upon Gruner.
Severely damaging his right hand and parts of his face. He will be disfigured for life.
But surely, if these injuries are as terrible as you describe them, then our purpose is sufficiently gained.
She'd love him the more. As a disfigured martyr. No. It is his moral side, not his physical, which we have to destroy. That book will bring her down to earth, and I know nothing else that could. It's in his own handwriting. She cannot get past it.
Neither my client nor myself can thank you enough, Holmes. Should either Miss Winter or even you yourself be incommoded by the police, do not hesitate to telephone me.
Thank you, Sir James, but to tell the truth, I rarely, if ever, find myself inconvenienced by Scotland Yard.
Good night.
Good night.
Holmes gazes wistfully. Outside, a coachman with a gold-ribboned top hat opens a coach door.
I would like to thank you too, Watson.
Thanks. Oh, by the way. Ming dish.
By Jove, yes.
Worth a king's ransom, I understand.
Sir James walks to the coach and climbs in, Watson grinning. The coachman closes the door, revealing a large royal seal painted on it. Watson's smile drops in amazement as Sir James quickly throws part of his cloak out over the seal. Watson stares at the departing coach and rushes inside.
Holmes!
Holmes smiles knowingly.
Holmes! I've discovered the identity of our client. It's none other than...
A loyal friend and a chivalrous gentleman. Let that now and forever be enough for us.
He raises his eyebrows. Watson's face sours as Holmes closes his eyes and rests. Now, a close view of Violet's hand on Grinner's open book. She turns a page to reveal her photograph on a blank white page. She closes it, leaving the book lying on a black background. This film has been described for blind and visually impaired audiences by Descriptive Video Service, a service of the WGBH Educational Foundation. Funding provided by the United States Department of Education. Descriptions read by Peter Haydu. Credits roll. The illustrious client. Jeremy Brett as Sherlock Holmes. Edward Hardwick as Dr. Watson. Anthony Valentine as Baron Gruner. Carol Noakes as Baroness Gruner. David Langton as Sir James Damery. Abigail Crittenden as Violet Merville. Rosalie Williams as Mrs. Hudson. John Pickles as Jarvis. Kim Thompson as Kitty Winter. Roy Holder as Shinwell Johnson. Andy Bradford as First Thug and Fighter Ranger. Music by Patrick Gowers. Produced by Michael Cox. Directed by Tim Sullivan. Copyright Granada Television, 1991. Executive Producer USA, Rebecca Eaton. Made by Granada Television of England in association with WGBH, Boston.